Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, August 14th, 2015. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. As selected by two experts in the world of the federal government, this week, expert number one is Dale Myerose of the Myerose Group. It's good to see you, my friend. How are you, General?
I'm fine, Francis.
Thanks for coming in and being back on the Countdown again. And we have a newbie on the Countdown with us this week. Guest number two is Steve Grundman of the Atlantic Council. It's great to see you, my friend.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Thank you for coming in. You've each chosen what you think are the three most important federal news stories of the week, and we have them linked on federalnewsradio.com. We'll start where we always do with...
Number three!
Dale Myerose' choice at number three is from govinfosecurity.com. The headline is VA Revamping Cybersecurity Strategy. I think of all of the things in this story that I found the most interesting, it was something that was kind of in between the lines. They talked about it a little bit, and that's the big turnover at the top of the CIO shop at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Laverne Council is in now,
right,
within the past month and a half or so after being confirmed by the Senate. The deputy CIO, Steph Warren, has left to go to the Comptroller of the Currency.
Right.
And Stan Lowe, the CISO, has retired. So it's a totally new start, essentially, at the CIO shop at VA.
It is. And that's one of the things that sort of comes out. I picked this, as you know. I usually do a cybersecurity one. And OPM and that breach has gotten all kinds of attention. What a lot of folks don't realize is in 2014, there were 61,000 breaches in the federal government. And so many of the agencies are looking at revamping their cybersecurity strategy. In fact, I counted 8 articles this week of just ones that I saw. And this one encapsulated a couple things and even has a couple of warning flags for us, I think. One is you cited the leadership turnover. The number one reason for failure that I find in going out to industry of a failed cybersecurity strategy is the lack of senior leadership involvement. So I consider this a red flag. I have come to believe that strategy is less about big thinking and more about corporate resolve. And so if this strategy is to succeed, it needs to find that leadership niche. And as I look, the thing that bothers me is that they're using experts from the VA's Information Technology Division. They ought to be using somebody in senior leadership in the VA. Every cybersecurity incident is an organizational crisis. Just ask OPM.
Mm-hmm. The issue at VA is, I don't think, as much a leadership problem as maybe people think. I'm struck by some of the comments that Secretary McDonald has made lately about the way that they intend to serve vets as customers. So I'm encouraged by that kind of leadership. I have a commentary up on federalnewsradio.com right now indicating that the problem that he has, though, is all of the layers of stuff, not just in VA that he's got to go up against, but outside of VA. He said, let's get veterans.gov. And just make it simple. Well, the problem is the Labor Department has veterans.gov already.
Exactly.
And so there are all kinds of, it's almost like the deck stacked against the agency to try to accomplish something.
Yes, even if you look at other parts of their infrastructure, their data is stored somewhere else. The business about who hosts their application. And so what we've allowed to have happen sometimes is when we look for dollar savings, we sometimes increase complexity. And by increasing complexity, we make it more difficult to deliver service. And that's what I read in Director McDonald's statements. We've got to get some simplicity back in the system.
I wish him and I wish Ms. Council, the new CIO there, and Sloan Gibson and the rest of the team at VA nothing but the best, because they have one of the noblest missions in the federal government. But, boy, are they up against a lot. Dale Myerose's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week, VA Revamping Cybersecurity Strategy. It's from GovInfo Security. Steve Grundman, your choice at number three is from the Seattle Times, and the title is Analysis, Boeing Jobs Threat Over Ex-Im Bank Stalemate Isn't All Bluster. There are a number of layers to this, not least of which is the implication of extraneous factors that people don't necessarily think of affecting the defense industrial base.
Yes, actually, that general point, which is throughout the summer, this dispute over the reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank has been percolating along largely as a inside Washington story. And so why I thought this was one of the three most important stories that I saw this week was that these, you know, pretty blunt statements, not only by Jim McNerney, the CEO of Boeing, but also the CEO of General Electric, Jeff Immelt, from back in June, about the you know, the potential for impact on jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, took this inside Washington story and made it more meaningful to the rest of the country. It indeed also has meaning for the general defense industrial base that may be inside Washington. Parts of it over at the Pentagon, for example, care more about as well. But it was really to put some context to and meaning to this otherwise arcane debate about the Export-Import Bank's reauthorization that caught my interest.
So there's one passage in this story that I think does a terrific job of summing up what the purpose of the Ex-Im Bank is. Iraq, in April, requested that an order of 10 Boeing 737s be approved for loan guarantees from the Ex-Im Bank. Without the guarantee, commercial banks would be reluctant to lend the hundreds of millions of dollars such a purchase entails. For the lending banks, Ex-Im removes the risk. If the borrower defaults, in this case it would be Boeing, the U.S. government will pay off the loan. So
right.
There is an understanding there that because this thing exists, there's a certainty for a lending institution that they wouldn't have otherwise. Do I read that and understand it correctly?
Yeah, it essentially creates a, it further diversifies the risk.
Hmm.
Right, there is, in that case, by the way, I just want to correct what you said. It's not, Boeing's not the borrower. Iraq is the borrower.
Thank you.
Iraq is getting commercial financing. And to diversify the risk to a degree that would make the terms of that financing palatable to Iraq and to the bank, the Ex-Im Bank puts a backstop, if you will, behind those terms, a fail-safe. So I do think that is a good. In fact, one of the other things I liked about this story, and it's nice to see it from a regional newspaper, is it's a great news story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a well-done news story that, again, tries to make sense of this otherwise arcane debate.
It does lay out very well the steps, explaining what the Export-Import Bank is and what it does and the status of the discussion on it in Congress. Steve Grundman's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week. Boeing jobs threat over Ex-Im Bank stalemate isn't all bluster. It's from the Seattle Times. And it and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Steve Grundman and Dale Myerose on the Federal News Countdown. This is the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Steve Grundman and Dale Myerose, and we are up to
number two.
Dale, your choice at number two this week is from the Washington Post. The headline is Beretta's Fight to Arm the Military. And this is another one that has a number of different layers to it. What are the layers in this story that you find interesting as we learn about Beretta's effort to try to sell firearms to the federal government in a way that they can stay in business and the American troop can get what he or she needs in the field?
Exactly. To me, this was a concise story that had several elements, as you said. Now, the first is that traditional military suppliers are facing competition from civilian manufacturers. And so the idea that says that corporations that haven't previously dealt with the government are all of a sudden now interested in doing so is one factor. The corollary to that is that the soldiers, the people in the government, a lot of their desires and views about what their product ought to be is affected by the commercial products. So they'll go to a rod and gun club or a rod and gun store or something like that. And so their handguns have got laser pointers and accessories and all those kinds of things. And the soldier comes back and says, you know, those are important. Why can't we have those in there? And so it's one of these things that I think that the federal acquisition in certain areas, this area, IT, a lot of the technical areas are facing the idea that the acquisition process is facing challenge both from commercial products and commercial vendors into the traditional venue.
Right, it's a microcosm of some phenomena going on both in the industrial base, but also it is a microcosmic illustration of an issue that is front and center in the defense authorization bill this mm-hmm. year, particularly on the Senate side. So To illustrate what I mean, for example, is this phenomenon of customers, in this case, you know, the Army, entertaining offers from what we would regard as commercial firms, is the same phenomenon at play when the Air Force or the National Aeronautics and Space Administration entertain SpaceX to come and compete for national security launches or for a resupply of the space station. So it's a neat little microcosm of a very important trend, and even a trend, of course, that in policy and both rhetorical and more practical, the acquisition system is trying to encourage. And so the authorization bill, particularly on the Senate side, has created, is attempting to put into law a large series of what they call pathways that would facilitate, facilitate the entry of commercial offerings like these and others. Well, and indeed many others in IT, more typically, is I think what those pathways are targeted at, not such things as this.
A brief history of handguns that this article provides. The M9 replaced the ailing, the story says, ailing Colt M1911, better known as the Colt 45, which had been in use since World War I. The M9 came into use in 1985, and Beretta started to make them immediately. Now the military would like to have its troops using a gun called the XM17, and that gun could be made by any number of manufacturers, it appears from the looks of this story. There are other companies that can benefit from the transition of that contract, and it would be detrimental to them, to Beretta, as it would be beneficial to any of these new companies. This is a story that we've seen play out time and time and time and time again throughout our history, isn't it,
absolutely,
Dale?
And again, the designation XM for the new one, the X is to be determined, and it's a set of basic requirements, and then industry, you know, decides how much it adds and how competitive to make the bid and all those kinds of things. And so the principle, like Steve said, is well used. There's another point brought up here, and that is the contract. The size of the contract itself is in the $400 to $500 million range. But it affects another $1 billion in expenditures. And again, that happens in many other contractual efforts. And sometimes because of the tail that gets driven, it either becomes additive to the original contract or spawns other contracts. And so this one happens to be a 2X. And again, in other lines of acquisition, that factor may be different. But again, this is a concise story that brought up all of those elements.
And just to round it off, there's even a globalization feature to this, not least of which is Beretta itself is an Italian-based company. Now, they had made themselves an indigenous supplier back in 1985, but among the commercial competitors that they are up against in the XM17 competition is Glock, an Austrian company. So again, this is again nice illustration of a bunch of really important, profound dynamics in the modern defense acquisition system.
Dale Myros' choice is the second most important federal news story of the week from the Washington Post: Beretta's fight to arm the military. Steve Grimman, your choice at number two is from Breaking Defense, and the headline is Kendall open-minded on sharing RD-180 replacement costs. The essence of this is really the 21st century space race as we try to figure out how we get around doing business essentially with Vladimir Putin to get people and stuff up to the International Space Station.
Right. So this plays out against the backdrop of this kind of high politic argument over responding to no less than the invasion of Crimea, for example. But against that big high politic backdrop, it was this very particular quote that really caught my attention, and I think people should read several times to appreciate the significance of. So this is Frank Kendall, is quoted in this story, speaking earlier this week, I believe, at the Space and Missile Defense Conference here in Washington.
Yes.
And talking about how to finance the development of an engine that would replace the, as it's called, RD-180. RD-180 is the Russian-built engine that we use on the Atlas V rocket. And here's what he says. He says, quote, "The approach we prefer, rather than just paying for new engine development, is to help someone close to their business case for providing launch services." Well, that's a quite different way of thinking about how the government participates in and induces the development, let alone the procurement, but induces the sale, but induces the development of a new technology. It's a co-development, mm-hmm. Or it's a shared investment. Now, this isn't the first time it will have been done. NASA did this. That's how the commercial launch services programs up to the space station got developed. But if you take this little microcosm, sorry to reuse the term so many times, you might imagine extending it to lots of things, where what the government is going to do is not from a clean sheet 100% finance the development of mm-hmm. it, but figure out in collaboration with partners what piece of their business case needs to be covered. This even has a little bit of a resonance back to the Ex-Im Bank point, yep. which is where government is coming in, basically covering the portion of risk that commercial sales will not defray.
Sidney Freeburg, I think, crystallizes the sentiment in Mr. Kendall's words there, I think, very well. He writes, in other words, could an infusion of Defense Department dollars or a promise of Pentagon business give companies enough incentive to develop a rocket engine where the return on investment would otherwise be too low? Dale, that's a rhetorical question that Sidney's asking there. But to me, the answer to that rhetorical question is, well, duh.
Yes, absolutely. It's like we keep learning the lesson that scale has its own rules,
mm-hmm.
whether you're talking about big scale, medium scale, or small scale. And in this case, where do we set the scale? You know, do you put the development on one, set it aside as a shared cost? Do you, you know, and so where do you start the scale in order to create the rules that build your business case? How do you provide those incentives? And the thing that when I was in U.S. and Air Force Space Command that we battled all the time was, how do you maintain your agility and your speed in order to deliver? Because so many of these systems take long periods of time and generations of technology go by before you actually take advantage of them.
Mm-hmm. The thing that I think is really noteworthy about this, Steve, is this is not some pedestrian procurement. This is not... let's try it on this little thing that doesn't have a lot of risk involved and right. see if it works. He's going full bore if you're talking about mm-hmm. the rocket engine that we're going to use to get stuff into space.
Right, and
it's
against
a big
the backdrop
freaking deal.
Of an imminent law to forbid the use of the RD-180 engine after two or four more years.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's the rocket that we put our big national security rockets into space on, and or payloads into space on. Yeah, high stakes. It's also hardly a pedestrian voice, right?
That's right.
Chief acquisition
it's the guy
of all the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Just to underscore, I thought that's an unusual, right? That is a remarkable thing for him to say mm-hmm. about a major acquisition
yeah.
that has high stakes. And I didn't want it to go unremarked as if this was, just another gambit.
It's possible, he said, that we won't be able to close anybody's business case, in which case we'd look at actually funding an engine and providing it as government-furnished equipment to various launch suppliers. But they're going to try to do it the other way first. Kudos to them.
Right.
You know, it seems to make a lot of sense in an environment where you want to try to conserve dollars wherever possible. And especially, there's a benefit there, a clear benefit potentially to somebody if it works out the way that he hopes, where there are a lot of people that have expressed a lot of at least indifference and in some cases apprehension about the Pentagon's desire to shift more of the R&D costs to the vendors without much of a guarantee that they're going to have anything to show for it on the other end.
This also, by the way, echoes back to this point about commercial competition, because there's an aspect of this that is not spoken to here, but which is in play, and that is there are a set of vendors who, because of the way they're capitalized, could participate in a cost share, a risk shared program like this, and there are other vendors who really are only structured and capitalized in a manner that could participate if the government pays the bill.
And we've seen this before in space programs of competing national teams with mm-hmm. with scale downs and compete offs early in the thing and dropping vendors off. We've seen that play out several times before. Mm-hmm.
Steve Grundman's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week is from Breaking Defense. The headline is Kendall open-minded on sharing RD-180 replacement costs. You can find that and all of the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week is chosen by Dale Myros and Steve Grundman on this week's Federal News Countdown. This is the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The three most important federal news stories of the week, selected this week by Dale Myros and Steve Grundman. And we're up to
number one.
And Steve, your choice is the most important federal news story of the week from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is Buffett's Berkshire to buy precision cast parts for $32 billion. And I will say, in the nearly 5 years I've been doing the Federal News Countdown, I think this is the first Warren Buffett reference, which is fine.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's just something I didn't see coming.
Okay. So what's this got to do with federal news? It's this. That this will undoubtedly be the biggest transaction in the aerospace and defense sector, which is still regarded as a coherent collective, even though there are distinct end markets that they are working and that this transaction plays to in different ways. But this will be the biggest deal in a big M&A year, right? So 2015 will be, by the time it's all said and done, particularly now that this deal is done, we'll have more transaction volume in aerospace and defense by a factor of at least two, probably three, now that this deal is done, than any year since 1999. And so what? I haven't quite answered the question yet about what's this got to do with federal news. It signals a bunch of things about the efficient structure of the aerospace and defense sector that will play out not only in the commercial aerospace sector, which is primarily where Precision Cast Parts has its revenues exposed, but also in the defense sector.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I think this ratifies the idea of conglomerates playing in aerospace and defense. Now, there's a counterpoint to that in play over the summer, which is the divestiture by United Technologies, another conglomerate of Sikorsky. But nonetheless, I think it puts on the radar screen of bankers and other corporate development people that conglomerates are paying attention to aerospace and defense, and that will have a significance, I think, ultimately for the structure of defense industry. It makes a big endorsement of the value of large scale far upstream in the supply chain. So what Precision Cast Parts does is they make big forgings and structures. They are at the, you know, in a value chain sense, they're sort of at the tier three level of the industry. But to, you know, who knew that there's a tier three company out there with more than $30 billion of value to itself? And they've done that by diversifying and gaining scale and a over-the-top bid from the likes of the something of Omaha,
Oracle of Omaha.
Again, starts other companies down in tier three thinking, oh, is that the efficient scale? Is that what's rewarded by the capital markets? I could go on, but let's leave it at that for the moment.
The story says that Portland-based Precision Cast Parts, who I'd never heard of before,
okay,
I read this story, mm-hmm, supplies parts such as fasteners and turbine blades to aircraft makers and makes pipes and other equipment for power stations in the oil and gas industry. Nearly three-quarters of Precision's sales were to the aerospace industry, the rest coming from the energy and power sector. So I think Steve's point, Dale, is very well taken. Especially the part about what this portends for the rest of the industry. He mentioned the Sikorsky divestiture. Lockheed's buying that, getting out of the IT services business. Yeah. So there's a potential for a tremendous amount of churn, even if nobody gets tremendously bigger, if none of the big five get tremendously bigger in the next year.
Sure, and you have to look behind the motivation. So UTC selling Sikorsky to Lockheed. You know, one could make a case that Lockheed is not only a global company, but it's very, in some cases, regional within the United States, and that expands the Lockheed reach, both influence, going for talent and things like that into the Northeast, where historically Lockheed has been fairly light. Not that they've been void, but they've been light, and so Sikorsky strengthens, gives them other access to talent. Other venues and things like that, and that's some of what I see the Oracle of Omaha doing here as well. I don't think he's looking to mix up the aerospace industry per se. I think he's looking for the positioning of how does all of the investments and things that are a part of what his enterprise is plays out in the new economy that may be emerging in our country.
Yeah, don't let me of all people presume to tell you I understand Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett, but this feels like a kind of a classic Warren Buffett investment. It's a business he understands. It's not IT. It's an industrial business with proprietary processes. It is a heralded management. You're not alone among most of the people in Washington who've not heard of Precision Castparts. People in the aerospace and defense industry, they all know Precision Castparts. And yep. Among the first three things anyone would say about it is great management team. And it comes along at a time when, and I really only myself learned this reading the news this week, he had a boatload of cash he had to do something with, or, you know, before his own shareholders started wondering how he's going to get growth
right.
out of all this money sitting on his balance sheet.
And this article does a good job of talking about some of the other potential acquisitions that he could make or won't be able to because mm-hmm. of the money that he's investing here. He will borrow about $10 billion, this piece says, to fund this $32 billion acquisition. And he talks about all the reasons why he's happy to do that. And mm-hmm. I also don't claim to be an expert on Warren Buffett's acquisition methodology, but Dale, you certainly can look at the menu of companies that he's bought into, and you see there are no bummers among them. He's not a risk taker.
No,
he buys companies that make money and have staked out terrific market shares within their sectors.
The things that stand out, the one thing that stands out amongst all these companies that, to the extent that I know about them, is they execute.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mr. Buffett tends to go not with the penetrating technology, bleeding edge kind of idea or thought. From what I can tell, just with the companies that he's working with in this particular sector, he's going after those who execute and execute mm-hmm. well.
But to go all the way back to the top of your question, one could not overstate the significance of a Warren Buffett making a big, right? And to put this in perspective, $30 billion is big by an order of three times compared to the largest transaction that has come down the pike this year. Can't overstate the significance, the signaling that creates for the rest of the industry. Every private equity group with any aerospace and defense part of their portfolio now starts asking themselves, okay, what does that mean for me? All of the strategic players in aerospace and defense now ask, okay, if that's how Warren Buffett sees value in this segment, mm-hmm. what does that mean for us?
And I know that all of the money, all of the sales that this company made were not to the aerospace industry. And I know all of their aerospace business was not to the defense sector.
Correct.
But
correct.
Boy, it's got to be a big chunk of it.
It's a meaningful chunk of it, but it's by no means even it's a minority chunk of it. Defense.
Yes.
Right? The biggest chunk of it and the biggest tailwind that this transaction has to go for has going for it is the commercial aerospace. Commercial airliners, big, you know, wide body and narrow body, but big commercial airliners made by Boeing and Airbus primarily. Precision Castparts is a major, albeit at the tier three level, supplier to those products. And there is a long run of order books that have to play out over the next 15, 20 years. That's what he's really playing this toward.
But yes, agreed. But there is a significant enough piece
yes.
of the defense industrial business in their book of business that had to be a consideration. Oh, by the way, you must be aware you're also getting into this business too, I would think.
See, I think this is a nuance with importance. And oftentimes, you know, everybody gets the 80% or whatever, but you know that last little bit and the bit about the aerospace piece and how it executes in the aerospace industry, mm-hmm. I think is a nuance with an importance in this instance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Steve Grundman, is from the Wall Street Journal. Buffett's Berkshire to buy Precision Castparts for $32 billion, and you can read that story through a link at federalnewsradio.com, just like all the stories, as selected on the countdown by Dale Myros and Steve Grundman. And when we come back, Dale's choice is the most important federal news story of the week on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Steve Grunman and Dale Myeros. And Dale, your choice as number one this week is from Fierce Government IT. The headline is Presidential Advisors Recommend 8 New Focus Areas for IT Research and Development. Now, I remember a discussion that I had with a very high-level IT exec when Vivek Kundra proposed his 25-point plan. And they all 25 points were very valid and very useful. My thought was, how do you focus people on 25 different things that they have to do? 8 is even a bunch. What's your takeaway from this story? What struck you about this that was impactful?
Okay, so what strikes me is that there are a lot of headlines out there, and there are a lot of headlines that grab people's attention. There are a lot that fly under the radar of government processes that establish public policy over time. This is the PCAST, which is the White House President's Council on Advisors in Science and Technology, is one of those. There are others. And just to give you a feel, the past subjects that PCAST has worked has been U.S. advanced manufacturing technology, nanotechnology, education technology, antibiotic resistance, systems engineering and healthcare, big data privacy, and climate change. And so I found 6 other stories related to the IT research and development areas of these new areas, which mostly center around cybersecurity, IT, and healthcare, which then plays into the idea of what we hear about breaches and risk and fraud and all of those other kinds of things. And these are the kinds of things that while these new areas are introduced now, they will play out over the next 3 or 4 years. They will end up developing programs. They will have bins of money. Across the departments will have efforts and projects which will support all of these kinds of things. And in fact, in their own budgets, will find justification for why they are spending money in certain things based in government processes that play out just below the radar that the professionals within the government know about, but the public is largely uninformed about.
Mm-hmm. You saw some irony in this story, Steve.
Well, when I first read it, I could not imagine why a guy of such an astute judgment as Dale would have chosen this as the biggest story. But then we talked about it a little bit, and what it brought to my mind was, of all things, the program structure at the Pentagon. And the power of those definitions, the power of the program definitions in terms of, the themes of them, the purposes of them, which, of course, have to be fleshed out in more than mere terms, in more than mere titles. But, you know, they organize and orient. They create gravities. They create little centers of gravities that over time really do shape what the government buys, and in turn, what, you know, someone looking for a grant or, you know, looking to get some government investment in their new idea, you know, orient on. I get it now.
I've got 3 very quick examples of other articles this week which reinforce this. And that is President Obama has made a proposal for $262 million for HHS cyber threats. If you look at the language of that article and the language of this article, that kind of looks like they spoke, all right, then the Air Force is seeking bids on insider threat projects. And that was another article this week. Mm-hmm. And lastly, NIST, working on its cybersecurity refinement, not only of its framework, but rollout of certain keying standards, encrypting standards, and all those kinds of things. You look at that language, and lo and behold, here it is too. Mm-hmm. And so these are reinforcing things that have long-range impact and I think really, really play out. And as a former program, United States Air Force, I continually looked for what were the reinforcing things across government that I could get, which it could help me make my case for why my project should have priority.
Mm-hmm. I feel compelled to tell an anecdote from just earlier this week, specifically on the IT and health dimension. So for reasons that aren't germane, I was at a conference of the American Hospital Association on material management, a supply chain conference on material management. Not my bag ordinarily, but there I was. And in the exhibitor hall, I expected to see gurneys and trays and push carts and the entire exhibit hall, I swear, except for maybe two of the stands, were big data. They were all basically
privacy. They
were various formulations.
Electronic
of
health
IT
records.
Companies doing health records and supply chain management and basically working data problems to create efficiency for this industry, which is now under the gun of the Affordable Care Act. So yeah, I connected those two things as well.
The flexibility that this group is talking about struck me, Dale. This says, the story says, traditionally multi-agency focus groups existed across government that correspond to the PCAs, but these two should be more flexible, says the council. Eric Schmidt of Google, along with another member of this group, said some groups may have long lives while other groups should stand up and end in as short as 6 months or a year, all while remaining flexible for change. The reason that jumped out at me is because it's easy for somebody from Google to say that. It's hard to make it happen inside the federal government, which has a tendency to perpetuate its existence when it comes to any kinds of functioning groups.
Absolutely. But I think it also behooves us to look at the PCAST composition. And so OSTP is one of the co-chairs, and then they pick one of the other 17 members, and it happens to be Eric Lander, who's the director of MIT and Harvard, technology area. And so all of these members are in fact a mix of academia, industry, and it's another way, just like several other presidential forums that many people in the government know about, in which industry, academia, and government are working processes that aren't sexy, don't show a lot of headlines or whatever, but are these steady things which provide this steerage, if you will, of major programs and government efforts.
You know, what I was reminded of when I read that sort of complaint or it was a call for flexibility was an argument that we had when I was doing program planning in the Pentagon in the mid-90s. Over the structure of the defense program, which was defined in the 1960s by the Whiz Kids and Bob McNamara, and the two core programs in the Pentagon's program are called General Purpose Forces and Nuclear Forces. Why? Because in the 1960s, that was the big trade-off.
Yep.
Those were the big trades that were being made. By the mid-1990s and certainly today, there are lots of other mission areas and forces and force types that don't get captured in those lenses. So I was reminded by that comment of the fact that there's something to that. You do need to remember that, you know, the technologies change, missions change, and if you lock these program structures in too hard, they ultimately, you know, they constrain the aperture on how you understand what you're doing in a way that actually is counterproductive.
I cited Eric Schmidt of Google and his co-author in the comment that I cited a few moments ago, Susan Graham, who's chair of the Computing Community Consortium. They posted those comments on a blog post at the White House's blog. All right, overall on this, is the government willing and able to be that flexible when it comes to these structures, Dale?
That's a good question.
That's why I asked it.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And again, if you look at the nature of these new topics, they demand that. And how many times have we brought that up of commercial products, globalization, things like that, in the areas that these topics are specific to? So I think they're, in some regards, they're stating the obvious. But like Steve said, some of our appropriations are stuck in an era where the definite, you know, for instance, we have two intelligence programs appropriations. One's the national intelligence set of appropriations, the other is the general defense intelligence appropriations. And so you divide the world in half that way, and there's really different ways to divide it, to think about it, and it's one of those things that I think we will continue to see an evolution on in the subjects that we talked about, both, you know, in almost every single article that we talked about today. I think that underpins some of the statements made by members of the PCAST. It says, okay, these new areas need to be explored, but we need to maybe explore them in a little bit different fashion.
Just a minute or so left, Steve. Is there a way – to go back a year or 2 years from now and look at this effort and see if it developed the way that it should have? Or do we just have to kind of figure if these categories, some of them exist and some of them don't anymore, or some of these structures have been stood up and some of these groups don't exist anymore, that that was good enough?
I would be tempted to say that there's probably a follow the money test that could be applied in a couple of years, which is to say, you know, follow the way money got allocated to these categories, mm-hmm. and then step back and look at those proportions and ask the likes of an Eric Schmidt, you know, does this sound like it is responsive to contemporary dynamics of the market?
Yeah, if I might, the list of eight categories I gave just prior were the survivors of the process. That was not all the things that the PCAST had been recommending over mm-hmm. the course of the past 7 or 8 years. Those were the survivors, the ones, you know, that had legs, had meaning, and did, in fact, mm-hmm. affect government policy.
Dale Myers' choice is the most important federal news story of the week. It's from Fierce Government IT. The headline is, Presidential Advisors Recommend 8 New Focus Areas for IT Research and Development. And that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown are archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The entire show is archived there, too. Gentlemen, thank you very much for a terrific Federal News Countdown. Dale Myers, great to see you as always, my friend. Thank you for coming in. Steve, a nice job for your first Federal News Countdown. The problem with that is that means we'll ask you to do it again.
All right. I would be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you very much for doing it. And the Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio.